I'm wearing a light hoodie today because it's nice and chilly this morning, and I'm like, cold. Oh man, fall, it's right around the corner. And then I pulled out the weather this morning. I'm like, looking at the weather, what's next week going to be like? 95 degrees.
Oh boy.
It's going to get hot again. Next week's going to be even worse. So, oh well. How are you guys?
Every morning, nearly every morning, I have what's called porch time. So between like 8:15 and 8:50, the dogs and I go out on the porch and we just drink coffee and sometimes I just kind of get ready for the day. Sometimes I just watch videos.
Dogs and, drink a lot of coffee?
What's that?
Do the dogs drink a lot of coffee?
They do. Yes. Yeah. And then today I had to text Kelly. I'm like, it was almost too cold for porch time, but we got through.
Yeah. We got through. We made it.
But we got through.
You can it, yeah. Snuggle up with the dogs and keep you warm.
It's one of my favorite times of the day.
Yeah. Mm. I really like quiet, slow mornings like that.
Yes.
You know, it's, we were,
then you start checking
yesterday.
Your emails and you want to jump in front of a truck.
Well, that's an interesting, like, thing that I'm working against, like a habit that I'm trying to break is, so yesterday it was also chilly, you know, it was nice. And so Jenny was out sitting at our table by the pool. Pool's covered because it's, you know, it was not that warm yet. It was in the shade. Sun was coming up, but it was in the shade. So she was sitting out there reading, and I went and sat and just drank my coffee. And the phone, I set the phone on the table and was just really enjoying the moment. And I would go to reach for the phone and be like, hey, I should check in on the day. I'm like, nope. Just push it a little bit further, you know, like it, yeah. Just not yet. And so it was a really nice 30 minutes of just sitting in quiet. And then eventually we started talking, and then it was really nice of, you know, just talking and being phoneless and in the cool. And yeah, it was great.
There's a book I read a while back called Limitless by Jim Quick. And in the book, he talks about don't read your messages. Don't look at your phone until 2 hours after you get up. Allow yourself to go through your routine. I've gone through bits where I've done this, but it's really hard. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. There's something irresistible about my phone in the morning. Like, ooh, who commented last night from the other side of the world on a video or whatever, you know?
That's the
you
way
know, one
we
of the
are,
weird things
program now for that.
About that whole thing for me that, like, you know, being attached to your phone, I think I've gotten a lot better about it. Like, I don't have notifications on for comments or any of that type of stuff. And so I get to that when I get to that, whatever.
Yeah.
The thing that and there's a lot of people that talk about, you know, you shouldn't have your phone in your bedroom, like use or by your bed. So it's not the first thing you do. It's not the last thing you do when you go to bed. You put it somewhere else, another room or other side of the room or whatever. And to be perfectly honest, the reason that I have a hard time with that is because there are a few situations in my life where I want to make sure that I'm available. And I'm really worried that if I, you know,
it's the way we're connected.
If I put that phone in the other, but not available to everybody, but like health situations or if there's a few people, you know, that if they need me, I need to be ready to go. I need to be able to respond. And that's the big, that's not going to go away. That's going to be the rest of my life. There's going to be people ahead of me or people behind me that need to get in touch with me.
That's
for
that
an
gut
emergency
punch when you realize your phone has been on silent for an hour and you go look at it, you're like, oh, and you run to it and there's like 15 missed messages from somebody, you know, and then you panic, you call, you're like, is everybody okay? You're like, yeah, I just couldn't find where you put that battery. You know, when it's like, you're like, oh, that's it. Thank God. Versus, you know, so-and-so get hit by a car or whatever.
Right.
You know,
so that's my one like thing I can't quite disconnect, you know, and because of that.
I put my phone on like do not disturb a lot, and I got to remember to take it off. For instance, Dave, we were talking about that big machine, that 5-axis CNC machine came the other day, and it came 10 days late. It was supposed to be here like 2 weeks ago, and I talked about that. And the day it was supposed to come, my phone was on silent, and it was supposed to come between 1 and 5. And it was like 4 o'clock and my phone had been on silent for the previous 3 hours. I was like, oh my God. I like turned it on and there's no missed calls, no notifications. I was like, thank God. And then 10 minutes later, it's like, hey, I'm out here. Where are you? And so the timing worked perfectly.
You got to schedule that, Jimmy.
Yeah. I just forgot. I just completely
You can schedule all the do not disturbs on your phone.
Yeah. that is stressful. I recently tried
to do the thing where, you know, I have Do Not Disturb on at night. So it's like, I don't get any calls except from like my favorites list and stuff. You know, those are the emergency people. But I tried to do the thing during the workday where it's still, you're accessible, but it's not like it hides all the notification, the little number, the pop-up numbers and everything. And then I found myself, if I did look at my phone, I was more interested in, is there some hidden notification that I can't see because I have this mode on? So I tried it for a couple of weeks, but I found that I was like going to it more rather than just being able to glance and be like, nope, there's no email I need to check. Cool. Put it down. I would be like, well, there might be. I don't know. I have to click on the thing to find out if there is. And, you know, it's been more time. So,
well, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking.
Do you remember like a year ago?
Go ahead, Dave.
So my phone goes into work mode from 9 a.m. to 6, and only my favorites get through. And I didn't have you guys in my favorites. And like a year ago, you made me feel guilty and I cried, and then I had to add you. So your text would come through during the workday now.
Oh, good. I could bother you when this machine crashes for me.
It's okay.
Gotta remember to move Jimmy from my favorites for the couple weeks.
I don't wear Meta glasses unless I need to film something, but you see so many people now you talk to and they have their Metas on, and it's becoming so ingrained. It's totally not like Google Glass. Remember Google Glass? They'd basically be an arrow pointing at some moron wearing Google glasses over the head. Now the glasses, you got to like double check. Like Dave, I'm looking at your glasses. You don't have Metas on, but they could easily be Metas. So they're so integrated now. And what's next is just the thing constantly telling you, oh, mom just texted you. This is next. Don't forget this. You know, the thing's going to constantly be bugging you. So that's just like 2 seconds away.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's something I'm not a curmudgeon. I don't think, maybe I am, but there's a lot of stuff that I would like to move away from, you know, whereas I think in the past, just being someone who likes technology and likes new stuff, I would want to move towards and try it out. But there's stuff like that. And I'm like, nope, that's a downhill for me that I don't need. You know, like maybe for somebody else, they can manage it well, they can use it correctly and everything, but that's a connection that I do not need to have. So I got a good friend who has a pair of the Meta glasses, and he was telling us when we were in Savannah, he was telling me about how he uses them. And I could see like the big advantage, you know, his kids play sports and stuff, and he can be in their sunglasses. So he can be wearing them, watching the kids. And if he needs to record a clip of somebody hit, you know, getting a goal or something, it's like easy to do. It's the perspective. It's really cool. But then I've also seen videos of people walking down the street recording other people and it causing fights and it causing, you know, just, I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
No, that's where we're going pretty soon.
Everybody's lately.
Everybody's going to be wearing a camera all the time. If it's already there. That face out not. Facing camera is what I mean. Not I just the not. Phone. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm working on a private job right now that I have to install tomorrow. And so I've been working on all the elements for that private job. It's, I was going to make a video of it, but it's just, there's too many scattered pieces. My friend Danny is his makerspace at his, private school downstate. I'm making one of the rooms look like inside of the Millennial Falcon, Millennial, inspired by the Millennial.
Got it. Aluminum Falcon.
Millennial, the Millennial Gen X Falcon. I'm trying to make the inside look a little bit like that, inspired by it. There's going to be a lot of elements in the room. So this is just a little wall treatment and then a sliding door and then some cubbies for some of the project boxes. So I'm making all these various little things that I've made one way or another in the past. But so I'm going down to install that, which the reason I bring that up is because it's slowing down my other project, which would be the resin cat, which I would like to try and figure out toward the end of the week if I can turn that into a full video or at least a 10-minute video. And that what it needs now is it needs just needs a stand. And what that stand is, I'm not sure yet. So I'm working on that. I was going to make it into a table, but something tells me it would be nice if it was just on a pedestal standing up almost like a tombstone, but like a long flat tombstone because it's long and wide and 4 inches thick. So I might make it look more like a science display. So that it's standing upright with a light in the base. So that's probably what I'm going to do because I have enough tables. And it'll just be the big chunk of resin sitting in that with possibly a light in the base. So I'm working on that in my brain. A lot of times I work out something in my brain, which is, once I figure it out in my brain, it gives me, it's just making it is the easy part. The hard part is figuring out what exactly it should be. So that's where I'm at right now, even right. though it doesn't, I'm not physically doing it. It actually is getting worked on in here. And that's what I'm doing. That's pretty much what's going on. And then I got this new machine.
How was the bowling thing?
What's that? What'd you say?
How was the bowling thing this weekend?
Oh, I forgot we went bowling. I completely forgot about that. We did. That was great. We drove out to Portland. I picked up Derek in Boston and we went up to Portland, Maine. And we went to this place called Bayside Bowl, which some of my friends and fans are like, that's a famous place. That's where they do tournaments out of. And I haven't bowled as an adult that I could remember. And me and Derek went the night before we went to dinner. Everybody met up with Carolina Shoes and Dexter Bowling Shoes. We met up and we went to dinner and then we said, hey, let's go to the bowling alley. We got a couple hours to kill before they close the night before. And we went and Derek and I were like the two old men in the Muppets that sit in the balcony, like with two curmudgeon-y. So we're just sitting there like watching, like, we'll bowl tomorrow. And then it was like an hour left before they close. And I look at Derek, I'm like, let's just try it. Well, so tomorrow we don't seem like complete noobs. And so we got a lane and the two of us did really well. Cause we just have good upper body strength from just being like blue collar laborers our whole life. So we could throw the ball straight down the middle. I can't put a spin on it or anything. So you see these guys doing these beautiful hooks. So it hits at like a 5-degree angle. I just throw it straight down the middle and it knocks over the pins almost every time. And Derek, same way, just brute force throwing the ball just right down the middle. And so I felt a little bit more confident going into the game. And then our team, it was four teams, our team won first place out of the first rally. So then we sat on the sidelines and the other three teams played off each other until there was a second place winner. And then we played each other and we lost to them only because the number one rated bowler in the entire globe happened to be on their team. Every time, I wish I could remember his name, JT or TJ, somebody like this, anybody a bowling fan, JT, TJ, forget his name. And every single time he threw a ball, he'd throw it and then just like walk back as the ball's halfway down and then boom, strike. It was so cool. Like the guy had such confidence. He would throw it and then turn around and just like casually walk back while the pins all fall down behind him. It was pretty cool.
Put sunglasses on and then explosion behind him. That kind of guy.
Exactly. just like yeah. The Batman, the Joker and the Batman when the explosion happens behind him dressed as a nurse. It's like one of my favorite scenes in any movie. So it was a lot of fun. It was much more fun than we all expected. I think we all went away from that being like, hey, we should do like a bowling league. But in the beginning, we're like, bowling? I haven't bowled ever. But we left and it was a lot of fun. So it was a real good weekend. So, and then, I get home and I went right to work on this classroom stuff. So that's it. That's what I'm working on. I'm going to try and finish the classroom stuff today. I got to load my car tomorrow. I got to install. Downstate is 100 miles away, so it's fun. And I'm packaging. I should get all the product this week. Everybody who bought my product, my Summit, the knife sheath thing, I should be getting them probably tomorrow, the next day. So I'll be able to package them and get them out within the month of August, which was the promise. And that's it. So everything's moving smoothly.
Cool. Right on. David, what about you? What are you doing?
Finishing up it sounds boring, but I'm finishing up a serving tray at the rental. There's no coffee table. There's just an ottoman, and the previous owners just had a little serving tray on there that you could set your drinks and stuff on. And so we've been using that, and I wanted to make my own. So I've been undoing that, and I was telling Kelly, I'm like, this is so not interesting. It's so simple and there's no real challenge in it for me. And only 10 people are going to watch this video, but it's a thing that we need. And I woke up the next morning, the day we were supposed to start filming. And I was like, well, I think I'm going to do finger joints. I'm going to change it up and I'm going to do finger joints. Well, I should just show how to make a quick finger joint jig on the table saw. And then it turned into, well, if I'm doing that, I should also show you if you have a router. And then what if you have a router table? So in the video, to complicate the video, which is a classic Pacciuto move. Anytime I make something, I find some way to complicate it. But so in the video, the first half is just three ways to make box joint jigs. One at the table saw, one with a router without a table, and then one with a router with a table. And then there's this marquetry piece where the rental is. There's a pair of sandhill cranes that are on the other side of the channel. And we see them every morning, and they're doing sandhill crane stuff. And so that's the inspiration for this little marquetry piece that I'm putting on there. And yeah, so a nice, and I'm making two trays. So the second tray is going to be for here at this house, but I haven't figured out what the marquetry design is for that yet. But yeah, it's funny. I was so disappointed in like, I didn't want to complicate the actual project just for the video, what I want, it needs to be simple and it needs to look simple. And I don't want to have this design that I drew up on the top. And then all my good ideas happen early in the morning. Like I wake up and I'm like, oh, I know how I can make this video a little bit more interesting. And if there's a little bit of a challenge to the project, I'm into it a little bit more. And so that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I do the same thing in a different way. I will complicate things in a way that is like, it's like using the wrong material or something like that. And really, it's because I'm trying to complicate it for the video. You know, but if there was no video involved, I'd be like, why in the world would you make it this way? Why would you go this way? And even the other day, I was trying to come up with an idea for, I've got this roof rack on my Land Cruiser. And years ago, I built one out of aluminum extrusions, right? So you have these slots built into them. And I, since then, have gotten rid of that. I bought a steel one with tubes, and then I got rid of that. And then I bought this other one with aluminum extrusions again that this company makes. And I don't know if they were inspired by my original design or not, but anyway, so I have this thing, and I was thinking like, what can I can design ways to carry small amounts of lumber on top of this rack quickly so that you could, instead of having to like get out straps and find a place to hook them and all this stuff, you can have a simple way to like throw some things up there, lash over pre-mounted stuff, and then just tighten it and you can go. And so, and this was all just inside in the shop, standing in front of a whiteboard. And so I start drawing out this, okay, you have a plate here, and then you have like a U piece that goes around the rack and it goes through, and then you have to connect these things in, and you got to have a thing so you can slide. And I come up with all this stuff, and I'm like, all right, cool. I should go take some measurements of these extrusions. So I go out there and I'm like, it's a T-track. There's all of the things that I designed to make an interesting thing to put on this are unnecessary. Every single bit of it. Like, it's a T-track. It's got a slot for you to put a bolt in there and tighten something down to it, which is why they made it that way. And I spent all this time trying to complicate things for a video. So anyway, so now I'm trying to come up with to use the end goal of that video, but make it so that it makes sense, like why someone would actually want to build the thing, or why I would even want to build the thing the way I originally thought of it. So anyway, but I do that a lot. So
I, the unexpected thing that I learned while making this video is really dialing down cutting veneers on a laser. So I had some time. And so I would cut the pieces and put them together. And I'm like, okay, there's always the curve of the laser, and the X-Tool software allows you to offset that a little bit. But I'm like, I want to know how to do this I want to figure out in Illustrator. So when I'm drawing my files, I can always have a layer that has all the offsets ready to go. And so I was like figuring out the offset for this particular laser and the wood I was using. And then I dyed all the woods. And if you've ever dyed wood, you can't sand it afterwards. because the dye never goes all the way through. You need like a vacuum chamber to get that, to pull the dye all the way through. So I'm like, okay, what do I really need to do to make this work and to have like a system for the future? So, you know, I raised the grain, sand it down. And then I was using alcohol dyes like that you would use for resin. And I would do a couple drops and then thin it down with some alcohol. And I was playing, brushing that on. I'm like, okay, this is good. So I'm like keeping notes of like colors and stuff that I was using. And my bench, it looks cool to me because it's just all these dyes and all these little swatches that I made of different colors and everything. And it's such a tiny little part of the video, but it's such a big part of the learning process for me of figuring out how to dye the woods. And so, and then when you use dyes, you can't just brush on a coat of finish afterwards because the dye is going to bleed into all the neighboring colors. So I've been shellacking all the pieces before it goes into the vacuum press. And then after it's all glued together, it gets another coat of shellac. And then I should be able to put polyurethane over the whole thing. But it's been a learning process. And it was supposed to be like this simple little project that was going to be real quick. And then it turned into something much bigger that I wasn't expecting.
So did any of that learning process make it into the video, or was that like off camera just...
It's a little bit is when I was doing all of that learning process, I was by myself. Jefferson was not here helping me film, and it was kind of late at night. So I would set up the camera and I would get a little bit, but I was really into like what I was doing and I wasn't really into filming myself. So I got little pieces and there'll be a voiceover that explains what's going on. And it's kind of sad because that could have been like the main learning point of the video. I don't know that anybody would watch that video, but maybe I can do a deeper dive in the future.
No, when you
interesting to me. You know, like that process sounds like something I probably wouldn't ever take the time to do the experimentation for, but I would love to watch somebody else figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Dave, you're doing laser, basically like marquetry, but with laser. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
And when you say offsets, that's so that you have a tight fit and the laser kerf is basically missing between the pieces.
Right. Yeah, there's like a 0.3 or 4, 5 millimeter space that the laser kerf. And so on simple pieces, sometimes you can just pull it together tight and then put a piece of tape over there. It's what like typical marquetry artists would do. But when you get a lot of pieces, you start seeing little gaps because you can only pull so tight after so long. And there's some various other tricks you can do. If you're using thicker veneers, the laser spreads out when it gets to the bottom. So you would actually cut it upside down. So the pieces kind of, and that's also a traditional marquetry technique is when you're using a coping saw, you cut it at an angle. And so the pieces kind of nest into each other. Now that I'm thinking about it, that might be a whole video on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you ended up, even if you didn't show making the final piece, but if you ended up with a really awesome visual piece that was the draw, and then it's, you know, the video is about like getting to that, not necessarily making it, but the learning and everything that I.
So traditional marquetry would use like four veneers at the same time, and you just rearrange the pieces, so the colored pieces. Are you're cutting it all out of the same colored wood, like separated, so you break your design up?
Yeah, I'm using all maple, like a double bat maple veneer, like the kind you get like a 2-foot by 8-foot sheet of roll. And so it's got a maple veneer on top and then some sort of other wood running the other way on the bottom. So it's real stiff. And it cuts great on the laser if you can dial in your settings. And then I chose maple because I usually use different species, but I really wanted to get into more colorful stuff. And so I've been playing with the alcohol dyes.
That's cool.
That's really cool. I lasered some letters recently and then took them to the bandsaw. So I was doing a little project for some friends of mine who are opening a bar, like a speakeasy here in town. And they called last minute and they were like, you know, our soft opening is tomorrow and we need, it's a speakeasy. So they have this door that is covered in white oak plank. So it looks like a wall that's like covered up. And then there's a time clock mounted on the wall, like an old school time clock that's hinged. And so you're supposed to walk up to it. You move the time clock out of the way, and then there's a code pad underneath it. You put in the code, and then this door unlocks, but it doesn't pop open. It just unlocks. But there's no handle or no way to grab the door because they thought it would originally like kind of, you know, like pop open and you could just grab the door and open it. So they called me over to see if I could make some letters out of this white oak to mount on the door face on these planks so that at least you had something to grab to. So they're explaining this whole thing to me and she's like, yeah, the company that put in the lock thing, like they said, there's no way to have the door pop open. And I'm like, what? Wait a minute. Here's three ways that we could do that. So I was like, you know, and so I may end up going back and figuring out how to get that thing to pop open. But, cause we've done that before. Like we did that with an electromagnet on Josh's secret door when you would turn the little potted plant and the door would release and push itself open a little bit. Anyway, so for now, because they needed it right off, you know, the next day, they just needed these three letters in the right font. And so I was immediately thinking of Jimmy, like, oh, he could like close his eyes and go to the bandsaw and cut these letters out in the right font. And I cannot, but I ended up taking, the guy that did all the work, who I'll talk about in a second, just gave me a piece of this white oak, a milled up little panel. And so I took the font, laid out just the outlines of these three letters, and then lasered, just etched, just barely on the top of this so I could have the outline of the letters really quickly, mm-hmm. and then took that piece of the bandsaw and cut directly to them because it was, you know, the simple letters, but I wanted it to be their matching font and all this stuff. And so the whole thing, you know, cutting them out and then cutting out the inside of the letters and sanding them and rounding them and then back cutting the center letter so you could get your hand around it, like a handle, all of that took like an hour and a half. I mean, it was easy work. But through this process, I got to meet a local woodworker who did a whole bunch of work inside this place, which looks amazing. Like it's awesome. The whole idea is called Off the Clock. And the whole idea is that it's like after your workday, here's this cool speakeasy bar thing that you can go hang out. And there's, I don't know, they're big on bourbon. So there's like a whole room with like a wall of special room that you can go in and rent. And there's this big wooden thing with bottles. And I don't know. It looks amazing in there. But the guy that did all the work is a local guy that I've never met, although we have a bunch of mutual friends. And so just from the process of getting that piece of wood from him to be able to cut the letters, we got to talking and he came over to drop the wood off and wanted to see the shop. And so we were talking about that. And then when I took the letters back to him, I took him to his shop and he lives out in the woods on a bunch of land and he built a like 30 by 40 wood shop. And so we went into his shop and he was just telling me about all the custom work he does and all, you know, just so much wood. So much wood he's got stacked up everywhere. He was like, well, if you ever need any of that, I've got a whole bunch of that and I've got a whole bunch of this. And it was really cool just to run into somebody that does fantastic work. And, you know, we know a lot of the same people and we've both lived here for about the same amount of time, but we've just never crossed. So anyway, that was just a really cool kind of accident. And I got to do a little, you know, a couple letters for my friends for their thing. So
nice.
That's one of the things I did this last week. And then, it's been a lot of like other, it's basically like last week when we talked about this, I haven't shot anything. I've just been doing random stuff around the house and cleaning up things and organizing things and designing and brainstorming, but I haven't done anything. It's just weird. Not bad, just weird, you know? Just
I think
weird.
We go through moods. Yeah, sometimes you do a lot of stuff, sometimes you don't. Just,
yeah.
It's life.
I've got three projects coming up that are all like stuck. They're all waiting on sponsors for product or for an idea or for an approval or something. And so those things are all kind of paused. And so I think today I'm going to go ahead and get started on, I'm going to build an aquarium stand for this big 60-gallon aquarium that I got. It used to be behind me for a long time, like in this room. And I finally moved it up into the house where we think it's going to go. And so I started thinking about building a stand for it. And this was when you were talking about the complications earlier. This is it. So, you know, an aquarium stand has to hold a lot of weight. But two by fours can hold a lot of weight. It doesn't have to be special. But so I'm thinking about building this thing, and I've built these before for this same size tank, and it's, you know, you can do it out of two by fours, you can wrap it in some sort of a wood that looks nice. And but I was thinking about, if I'm going to do this, it needs to be interesting. And so fast forward to now, it's this steel structure with magnets and connected removable trays, and it's just like, I just need a box to put the aquarium on, but now it's turned into this much larger, interesting to me, thing that would be way overkill for anybody else who would need to make one, you know. So it's not like it's going to be like, here's an inspiration for how to make a really, you know, the perfect stand. It's like, here's how to overkill a stand for no particular reason. But anyway, that's what I'm working on. So the complications are a thing, but you were talking before we started recording about control. And yeah, what were you saying about control?
So there's two things. Like, I think I struggle with giving up control when I need to or when I should. But I was having Jefferson help edit some videos, and we're getting through that, and I just realized that I really like editing. I feel like that is part of the creative process for me, because I'm editing in my head while we're shooting. I'm already thinking, like, we're going to film this part and then we're going to cut here. And so I told him recently, like, I think I'm just going to go back and do all the editing. I really enjoy that part, even getting the rough stuff together. And someday I'm going to have to give up control of something if I want to sustain this, but I don't know what I want to give up yet. And then the other part of the control thing is I like having ownership of my ideas. So a lot of times, somebody will comment or send a message or say to me in person, like, you know what you should do? And my immediate reaction is to say no. I'm trying to hold back. I tried to hold back from saying no. I tried to give it some thought. But the idea didn't come from me, so it doesn't feel like mine. I don't have control of the situation, and I'm trying to get better at that. And I thought maybe this would be a good topic to talk about. And Jimmy brought up this phrase that I've never heard before.
Yeah.
And
Not invented here.
I want to talk about that, because I'd never heard this before. And then apparently it's a common phrase, and I'm seeing
a lot of companies that do innovate. Companies that innovate, for instance, like a Procter & Gamble or any toy business, any toy company. Not invented here is a common phrase you've heard, because I'll come through the door as an inventor. I'll present several concepts, and the product acquisition person will be like, oh, this is cool, this is cool. And then it goes back to committee, and then you hear a week later and you get a rejection on like three or four, like the best ideas, you know, would be a perfect fit for that company. And then you come to find out through the network of people that know this company that, oh, that's where Joe Smith works. Joe Smith is notorious for not invented here. Every company he ever works at, if the idea doesn't come from him, it's not a valid idea. And that is a real thing that happens in the toy industry. I haven't been in the toy industry in 20 years, but in general, that's what was a thing. And you do find that from time to time when you meet up with somebody and you're like, I try not to spit ideas unless people ask, because I just know I don't want to hear a million ideas from a stranger. So when I'm in somebody else's shop and I see really cool stuff, I'm just like, wow, that would be great if they did this. This is what's going on in my head, but I never say it out loud, because I know that's a thing. People just can't help themselves giving me ideas. And I mean, it happens to both, all three of us, I'm sure. And occasionally somebody will spit out an idea that is just undeniable. And you have to go, oh, no, I have to do that because that is such a good, perfect fit that I didn't see directly in front of my own eyes. And I'm okay with that sometimes. It's never for me, if I didn't invent it, then I'm not going to do it. There are occasions where I'm like, okay, well, that is a very valid, good concept. And I use the example of the gullwing doors on the Woody. Rob goes, hey, let's make the gullwing doors on the Woody. And I was like, oh, because the whole time in my brain, I'm like, how am I going to split this door in two? They're going to be like barn doors with a set of hinges on this side, a set of hinges on this side. And I'm trying to like engineer and I'm like, oh, gullwing doors. I need one set of hinges on the top and that's it. I just got to get some pump jacks to hold the door open. So when he said that, I was like, oh, that's perfect. That's exactly what I'm going to do. But there'd be an occasion where it also depends on who it's coming from. Because if you have that annoying neighbor that comes through and then you do use their idea, they're like, we collabed on this. I'm like, no, we didn't. You know, that's like somebody that's like, hey, how's our idea doing? By the way, how's our video doing? He's like, shut up. You made a suggestion and I took it. So it also depends on who the idea is coming
from.
Yeah, they might have a really good idea. And then you say to yourself, that's a good idea. Like, yeah, no, I thought of that, but I'm not doing it because I don't want to do it because you just said it out loud. You know, you have to come up with some excuse because you know who it's coming from. That's another big part of it. If it's coming from somebody you like to collaborate with and somebody like you don't mind spitting ideas with, then, but if it's from somebody that's super annoying, you just go, oh, at least stop talking. We're almost going to be out of here in a minute. Then you could shut completely up. So it all depends on who it's coming from. Occasionally you see a good idea in the comment section and I could take that idea and use it and pretend like I thought of it already because there's no connection to the person. So that has, I'm not going to say that hasn't happened in the last 15 years where somebody's like, yo, you know, you should do this. And I'm like, oh, that's actually a smart idea. But usually by then the moment is gone. So if I do take somebody's idea out of the comment section, it's not going to be for that video because that's already published. Going forward, I'll just stick it in the arsenal and be like, next time I come across this type of circumstance, that's a good solution to that. I learned a tremendous amount from the comment section. People are always dropping knowledge and I think it's great. So,
yeah, I get a lot of that too. It is funny though, like especially with this last climbing wall, a couple of videos I've done, there's been a lot of suggestions that are not necessarily things I would do, but it really sounds like in the comment, like they're expecting it to, like, here's an idea that you should do about something that has already happened.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes, but I mean, like it's irreversible. It's not something you could add on later. It's like, oh, well, that understructure that is now covered up with multiple layers of plywood and paint and holds and stuff.
Yeah. So next time I build that wall, I might consider it.
Right. So that's always kind of interesting. I just don't know if people think all the way through and maybe they're just trying to be helpful and they don't, whatever. That's fine. But, I've run into that a lot recently. I think for me, the Hulk, I guess it is control. But one of the things that I struggled with after having people that I worked with, you know, when we had a whole team of people here and I would have an idea for something that I would want to make and that whether I asked for it or not, that idea would then become a committee driven idea. And then you have a bunch of people who are trying to be helpful with the best of intentions who are just like, oh, well, and you could, you know, or you should. And so then you have a bunch of different people coming at an idea that wasn't theirs from different directions. Again, with the best of intentions, mm-hmm. but I've stood in the back of those conversations and been like, no, that's none of that is what I wanted. I wanted this. And it can change, of course. I'm not being rigid in that, but I think that's one of the things that I have a really hard time with is that when other people, and I guess these are two different things now that I think about it. So when I have an idea and then I have other people come add to that idea and try to like make it theirs a little bit and like put their spin into it and whatever, that feels different than somebody coming to you with their own idea and saying, here, you should use this. I guess those are two different things. But I struggled a lot when we had a team of people with it becoming a group idea. My idea becoming a group idea.
I've been in meetings in the toy business where there's like 10 of us in the room. And then there's people that are just strictly finance. There's people that are strictly, they have like one account. And that's all they handle is just like Toys R Us. And then suddenly everybody in the room has equal say. And it is the most frustrating, annoying thing because you have the guy in finance going, oh, well, I like it if it had legs. I'm like, you don't matter in this circumstance. And I look at like the owner of the company. I'm like, why are you letting everybody have something to say? We should have a second committee where we're discussing the product.
Designed
These people
committee.
Only need to know about it once the packaging is designed. They're in it too early. It all it's doing is muddying up the whole waters. And it's okay if people, there are certain salesmen that I would always enjoy because they're very, very, very experienced. Some certain salesmen. I'm like, get Ned in here. Ned, get in here. What do you think about this? And Ned will be like, well, in 1975, when we were selling Star Wars, you know, like they have real educated opinion versus the finance person that goes, I like blue. Can we make it blue? I'm like, no. So it depends on the committee. I totally have been in those situations where too many people have too many things to say.
Well, Jimmy, in 1975, they weren't selling Star Wars yet.
I was going to say that, but I didn't want to.
77.
They sold it in 76.
I have found like the camera person I'm working with, like right now it's Jefferson or previously with my brother Daniel, they would say something and I'm like, yeah, okay. And then I wouldn't do it. And then after a little bit of time passes and it sinks in, I'm like, yeah, that's actually a pretty darn good idea. I think we should change it up. And I have to get past my initial reaction of just passing it off and, just.
Gonna let it marinate.
Once it sits in the brain for a little bit, you're like, ooh, yeah, I think that is a really good idea and we should go in this direction.
So I just realized this about myself in you saying that. What about the trade-off? So if somebody else gives you an idea or they want to help you do something and they can add something to what you're doing. For me, I'm almost, I don't even know how to say this. Let's take camera work. So I shoot everything myself these days. I have for a while. And I actually kind of enjoy that part of it. I know that there is a trade-off because I know that if somebody else were shooting, the overall coverage would be better because then you have two perspectives on the whole thing. You have more camera movement. You have somebody who's focusing just on the camera and just on the audio and not on the thing. And so I recognize that the output, the overall visual thing would probably be, or at least have the potential to be better with somebody else shooting, but I kind of enjoy doing it myself and I enjoy the drawn in nature of like me having to figure out how me wants to show me doing the thing to other people. You know, it's like all right there. And so I guess it depends on what you're talking about. But do you ever deal with that trade-off? And like, how do you deal with that? You could deal with it with an idea of like, I'm going to reject your idea just because it's your idea and there's a trade-off. Maybe it's a better idea, right? It could be execution of the idea, like the mechanics of it, the colors that are used. I know that I could go to Forby and ask for color suggestions for things because he's just a better visualizer than I am. He's great with design and color. And I could ask him, and I have. But I also kind of like picking my own colors. So there's a trade-off there. Like you're giving up like finish and finesse for preference, which I don't guess is a bad thing. But I don't know. Does that change anything with control for you all? Like the trade-off?
For me, a lot of times it's, I mean, this is a unique situation with how I work, but I am paying somebody to be there with me. And when they have a great idea, a lot of times that great idea sets the project back. And now I need a couple hours. I have to go back and I have to redraw something so we can execute that. And there are many times we won't execute the better idea because we are, it just pushes everything back.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes a suggestion is spit into the air and it's like, it's too late. It's good. It's too late.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tim. Go ahead, Bob. You go.
I was just going to say, I guess when I was talking about those comments earlier, that's the idea. I couldn't figure out how to say it, but yeah. It's too late. It's a good idea, but it's too late to put in place, or it's not efficient to use. Anyway, go ahead.
Once we were on a TV set, and my brother was always supposed to be the comedian. Me and my brother did 3 or 4 shows together, and anytime it was time to, occasionally the director would be like, okay, now this is like a funny moment, and my brother would say a couple things, and then people would bark suggestions from the peanut gallery, you know, the producers and the people. And my brother once turned to somebody and said, I had 4,000 thoughts between when I was asked and when I spoke, basically saying, every suggestion you all barked from the sidelines, I already thought of and decided those weren't good ideas. So occasionally that happens. And he said it more eloquently. He's like, I had 4,000 thoughts between a second ago and right now, and all your dumb ideas were in those thoughts and I edited them out. And,
wow.
So occasionally when somebody barks an idea at me, I go, oh, that's interesting. I thought of that 2 weeks ago when I very first began thinking about this idea. And that's just all the low hanging fruit. And so somebody walks in and they haven't spent 2 weeks thinking about this cat and resin, for instance. And people like what people walk in and they right away, they go, oh, you should have positioned him like, I'm like, he was frozen mummy. He's literally frozen in space with or without the resin. I'm not going to soften him up and change his pose. I didn't find a dead live cat. That people walk in and right away they go, why is he posed like that? Why did you pose? I'm like, because he's a dried piece of wood. That's how he was. So a lot of people don't realize you're completely, fully, 1,000% educated on every aspect of it. And 99.999% of the ideas that get spit out have already been thought through and pushed to the side. It's that one tiny, 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 tiny window of somebody going, burp, 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 and you go,
So this actually happens quite a bit with the camera people I've worked with, where like, oh, did you think about, like, I actually went through a lot of iterations, either sketching or in my head before this.
Yeah.
But so many times I'll say, yep, I've already thought of that. And then I get tired of sounding like a know-it-all. So I will be like, I will lie and I'll actually say, oh, that's actually a good idea. But unfortunately, we're already going down it's this too path.
Late. Mm.
Because I don't want to sound like a know-it-all all the time.
But at the same time, it is fair, what both of you are saying, that when we have something that we are planning, thinking through, you do spend a lot of time with your mind going down every rabbit trail, trying to figure out, like, is this it? No, is this it? No, is this it?
It happens when you're either conscious or unconscious. If it's if it's the idea of the month or the week or the day, your brain is in the background, re-editing it, thinking it through, doing this, and then suddenly to the forefront, your brain goes, oh, it should be this. And that's already happening in the background. And when somebody walks in and they literally like, why don't you do this? And you're like, oh.
And I think that's
2 weeks ago.
I hadn't thought about it until just now, but I think that's part of why I don't like getting other people's ideas. It's because it's... Yes, I already thought of that, but I don't want to, maybe low hanging fruit, but just not
Most of the time.
There's a million paths, right? And you have an idea. There's a million paths and you explore them far enough to know that's not the one. And then you go down another one and you go far enough to know that's not the one. And so you did all this pre-work and then you found one that you went down further and you're like, yes, yes. And so then when somebody comes behind you and says like, did you try path number 3?
Right.
Just like, I've been down all the paths. Yeah. And that's not the one I chose. And I think that annoys me, which is totally unfair. That's like me being impatient. I get that. Mm-hmm. But that annoys me more than like, you know.
When somebody hasn't been in the room, they don't realize the decision you make has to do with what tools available, what tools not covered by a broken down car, what material you have, what material you can go and drive to and get within a day. For instance, right. I go to Albany sometimes. Mm. So all that go, like, is my sewing machine work today? Or is it decide to today's the day it's not going to work? Do I have the right, I have a broken bit. I got to wait for Amazon to deliver a six pack of bits. You know, so there's all these things that go into, and then somebody walks in and goes, why did you do it that way? You could have done it this way. I'm like, yeah, the seven other mitigating factors that you have no idea about, including the fact that my knee hurts, you know, like whatever it might be.
Now, the flip side of that. The flip side of that, though, is that somebody walks in without all of the baggage that we carry about our own tools and about our own materials and our own experiences.
There's certain machines you just don't want to crank up. You're like, what a pain in the ass that thing is to dust off. I'd rather do it this way or use this.
Right, but other people walk in without all of that and can be like, well, this is the best way to do it. And as hard as it is for me, I have to admit sometimes that, yes, I went the long way around. I went the difficult way around because it 100%. Seemed at the time like the right thing. So... yeah, I mean, I know I have a hard time with that, but I think that is also partially why I keep, other than on this podcast, I keep most of my ideas and the things that I'm planning in my head or in my own space until they are in progress or done.
Mm.
I think because I just, you know, I don't handle the input well like I should, and that's a fault of mine. And then I just kind of don't want to deal with handling it poorly, so I just keep it quiet, I guess.
Yeah, I think we deal a lot of input overwhelm at times, and especially if you're not in the right mindset to receive input, it just feels overwhelming. Jimmy, going back to what you're saying, so many design decisions happen because I can't get the thing tomorrow by 8 a.m. because we're filming on Monday. It's Sunday night. I'm finalizing the design. I have a great idea, but I'm not going to get the thing in time. So I got to go to plan B all the time.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. People don't realize all the mitigating factors and, you know, I would love for this to be this beautiful 3D sculpted thing, but you know what? I don't have the time to learn how to relearn Fusion for this one project, and I can't get in touch with my friend who could do it better than me. So it's just going to be vector cuts for now, and then that'll be just as well. The other thing that this is a different subject, and I've talked about this in the past. It's as designers and inventors, we always know what is the best possible way, but we make a compromise, and the whole entire time we're like, I wish I had the time and the energy to do it the good way. So when you make it, you're apologizing to everybody that sees it. This is, I really would like it to be this. You got to remember, nobody knows the seven versions you had in your brain. They only know the one you present to them. And they're like, wow, that's amazing. You know how to use this machine and you could sculpt like that. And in your brain, you're like, I really should have had a 3D model. It should have been a 3D CNC or whatever the best version of that would have been. And so you're apologizing for it every time you show it off because you know in your brain you had more time, energy, right circumstance, it would have been this other, better version of it. But nobody knows that. So you just got to keep your mouth shut and just have that, just suffer alone in silence.
We had on our list of topics, we had ideal work conditions as a general thing. And I think that's one of those, like we can't talk about it now today, but that's one of those is that the time that we all work within that is self-imposed.
Yeah.
That the time constraint is one of those things that really affects and limits what we do. But the ideal work condition would be like, if I can't get it tomorrow at 8 a.m., it's okay because I can wait for the right solution. But, you know, that's not reality.
To push back on that, you think you want all the money. You think you want all the tools. You think you want the perfect work conditions. But those things, working without those things, the constraints make you stronger and make you come up with new and better ideas. So the more tools I acquire, I feel like the worse I'm going to get at design. That is an actual thought I've had in my head. Like, maybe someday I should get rid of all these tools and go back to a scroll saw and a hammer.
A scroll saw and a hammer would be a really interesting combination for a shop.
Yeah.
Like, that's all you had.
There's a lot of constraints there.
Any other thoughts on this? On other people's
ideas? I would say if you walk into your, I'm giving, this is a message to the audience. If you walk into your friend's shop and you have a good idea, maybe you could say, hey, are you willing to listen to a concept versus just barking an idea? I'd say, are you, you have any idea? Would you, I have an interesting idea on this. Would you like to discuss it? And then I guess saying no would be rude. So I don't know. Be more tactful if you walk into your friend's shop. Don't just start barking ideas. And a lot of times when you start barking ideas, what you're doing subtly and unconsciously is negating what they've already done. So you say, oh, this is great. This would be good in this other way. And you go, well, what about the way I did it? Let's acknowledge that I've gotten to this point because I went through thousands of decisions to get here. And you come in and you see all those thousands of decisions and you top it as if you're the genius. But I'm the one that got you here to be able to top it. So let's acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think asking that question is good. And I think it's not rude to say no. Because I think it's, if you're asking the question, you have to be willing to get a no as an answer, right? But yeah, I think that's, I know personally, I would be a lot more interested in receiving somebody's idea if they started it that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's my fragile ego.
When you say
ego,
no, they go, I'm never going to come up with another idea ever again.
And you're like, cool. That's why I said no. I don't, that's why I don't want your idea.
I'll never suggest another thing ever again. You're like, great. Yeah. Thanks.
I've also learned it is so much easier to come up with great ideas for other people because Jefferson, my camera person, has been like all in on acrylic pour paintings and he's doing all these techniques and these things. And I'm being that guy, but I keep throwing out, I'm like, you have some woodworking tools. Nobody else is doing this particular shape or this particular thing. We have 3D printers. We can create our own little pour thing. So it does a thing that, and like, I have so many ideas for him.
Right.
Because it's not a thing, but it feels like I don't have those ideas for me. It's because I know too much about what I do and I don't know enough about what he does.
Hmm. That's interesting.
There's another topic.
Yeah, for sure. Huh. Okay. Well, we're not going to do that today because we've been going for a while. But yeah, I agree with that. That's cool. I'm going to thank our Patreon supporters because they're amazing. Huge thanks to everybody, every single person over at patreon.com/makingit that supports the show. We're really, really grateful for everybody and for the long support from so many people. And it keeps us doing this show. I also, before I get to that, I meant to say this at the beginning, but I wanted to thank you two specifically.
Oh,
and I could do this offline. I know that. But to be honest, every Wednesday morning at 8:40, I go, man, I kind of wish we didn't have to do this today. Like, I wish I could just go like get some stuff done. And I know you guys are thinking the same thing, and that's fine. Like, it's
this
fine.
Again? Jeez.
But yeah, it's like, I don't know. We got to go sit and like, I mean, I love the guys,
well,
but like we
got to
go sit and talk, sit in one spot and talk for a while. But it's 10:25 at 10:25 every day. I go, man, I'm so glad we did this.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful that I get to talk to my friends in a way that I don't normally get to talk to them. And I get to talk about things that are interesting to me. And these guys we've all been continuing to push each other to be in this spot talking about this stuff for like 25 years now, every Wednesday.
Is it like
and
7
really,
years at least?
It's been 11, I think, or something.
Halloween's going to be 11, right?
But legitimately,
Dave, when's your anniversary?
Thank you to you two for continuing to get me to do this and to be here and to talk. I mean, like, I really mean that because it's... There's that part of me that always wants to like, let's just skip it or let's just not. But I'm always so glad that we do.
I mean, it's fun. It's fun when we get into the conversation, but I am better because of these conversations with you two.
Likewise.
I think about things differently because of the conversations that we had. And I hope the listeners get some of that too, but I know I benefit a lot from this podcast.
I definitely always think I have nothing to contribute. And then suddenly I do come up with interesting things and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Thought I forgot I knew that.
I'm way more interesting than I thought I was.
You guys pull it out of me because I think I have nothing to say. I'm sitting here like, I don't know. I have anything to say. These two young whippersnappers know how to use technology. I can barely email.
I mean, even outside the podcast, I'll be working on something like, how would Jimmy approach this? Or what would Bob think of this? And I do that all the time. I'm like trying to put myself in somebody else's shoes. And you two are my first go-tos.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you both.
Thank you.
And
thank
also, you. And the reason that came back to my mind is because the Patreon supporters make the show possible. You guys make it possible in a different way. But so just thanks to everybody involved. But
thank you.
Huge thanks to everybody at Patreon for just supporting us and being able to make it possible for us to get together and continue to do this after a really, really long time. And I hope that people on Patreon and everybody listening, that you get something enjoyable out of our conversations. Huge thanks to everybody over there, especially our top supporters. That's Works by Solo, Tinia Space Industries, Rich at Low and Art, Odin Leather Goods, Nick Ryan, Master of None, Jim from Wiser Bees, Daddy Yourself DIY, Chris McCormick from Hatch X, Chad from Mancrafting, Brian and Nancy Make Stuff, Albers Woodworks, and A Pretty Big Deal, Inc. There's a bunch of other people that we're really grateful for all the support, and everybody gets the after show. Doesn't matter how much you're supporting or how long you've been supporting or how long you plan to support. If you're on Patreon, you get the after show, which is a separate podcast of, it's 15, 20 minutes an episode after this one. And it's just more stuff, more conversation, different things. So if you want to get that, if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/makingit. There's a link in the show notes. If you ever just want to go click the link, that gets you the after show, the link for the after show and the link to the video after show and all that stuff. We appreciate it. I've got a couple interesting things to share this week. Do you guys have anything you want to recommend?
What was I going to suggest? Oh, I've been watching the Tupac trial. Have you been paying attention?
And no, I'm very unfamiliar with, I've seen the headlines, but I haven't been paying attention.
But I've been watching the highlights every day. And if you're interested in the Tupac trial and what's going on, there's, the one I like to watch is Emily D. Baker. I've talked about her in the past. She's a former DA and she's a law tuber. They call it now. If you're a lawyer and a YouTuber, they call it a law tuber. So I watch Emily D. Baker. So check out. She gives every day. She does the full live. And then at the end of the day, she does a summary of the highlights. So you get to see live, and she usually has it on delay so she could fast forward through the slow stuff. And then at the end of the day, she always does like a full wrap up of the highlights. So more law tube stuff. Emily D. Baker, Tupac trial. A lot is coming out, and they think P. Diddy might have to come to trial. Confronted with some new stuff that's coming out. They think P. Diddy had something to do with this. Which wasn't anything anybody thought about before this started. I mean, besides rumors, but now there's substantiated rumors. So they know where to find them.
Yeah. Yep. All right, David, what you got?
So mine is from the Museum of Modern Art's YouTube channel. They have a video and it's how to make a screen print step-by-step tutorial. And I think the title's misleading because it is a step-by-step tutorial, but it's this artist who does screen printing as an art, not as like a product type thing. And you get to see his creative process and how he comes up with these screens, and these images and the art that he makes. And it's just so well done. The Museum of Modern Art has a really good YouTube channel and some of their videos get like no views and there's so much production involved. Mm. And I don't know if they're used internally for something else, but if they're just made for YouTube, I feel so bad for them. Like this, it's the Museum of Modern Art. Like, these videos are so good and nobody's watching them.
That's interesting. I got to check that out.
Yeah. I got two. So one, I don't remember. Somebody sent me this on Instagram, I think. But this, I can't remember the name of the channel now. This guy, the channel's called Northern Outdoors, but he made the suspension bridge that I wanted to make in the woods. And now I'm not going to make the suspension bridge. Because it is no, watch the video.
You mean you can't compete?
There's no way I could. It's not even about competition. Seeing the amount of work and stuff that he put into it and what it would actually take to do it this well, no, thank you. I'll walk on the ground. It's really cool. And just just brute force work by this one guy to do this bridge. And it's about, it looks like it's about the same length that I would want to do. And so that's part of, you know, like, mine's not smaller. So it's this much work. And yeah, no thanks. It's really, really cool though. Really cool. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is I told you guys before we started recording, I've been working in Logic a lot more lately. My daughter, we're working on finishing up one of her new songs. And so I've been just trying to get better at it. And I've been watching videos and I've talked about some other channels that I've run across. But this channel is called Songs by Spencer. And I was looking for some vocal recording improvements and like how to improve them. And I found this channel. Now, the cool thing about this guy's videos, and I've watched a few of them now, is that the video switches between him singing and talking on and off like a bunch of times throughout the videos. And the singing sections are him showing what he's talking about. So the videos have to take forever because he writes little sections that he's singing and there's music behind him and everything. And so it's like in one of the videos, he's talking about vocal recording about, well, if you're too far from the mic, it sounds like this. So he sings a section too far from the mic and he talks, the lyrics are like, I'm too far from the mic and it sounds roomy and boomy and whatever, whatever. And then he does another one where it's too close. And so he's explaining through what you can hear what is good and what is bad about technique for recording and settings and all this stuff. And it's just a really cool. The music he sings is not my style. It's not about that. It's just that he's giving you an example of what is wrong or what is right through recording, not just talking about it, not just showing you settings. It's like, it's just a neat way to do it. And apparently he's got a bunch of videos about all sorts of stuff. So if you're into recording, go check him out.
Spencer lives down the road from me.
Really?
Yeah, he's from Toledo.
That's cool. Well, yeah. If you run to him, tell him I like his videos.
Will do.
That's really cool. Cool. You guys got anything else for this week?
I had something to suggest. I forgot what it was.
Okay.
I forgot. Well,
you can say it in the after show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
And we'll catch you next time.
Love you. Bye.